confirm or deny the intriguing suggestion that the legends seem to make, that something of great importance must once have occurred here. I remembered that Coatzacoalcos meant Serpent Sanctuary. It was here, in remote antiquity, that Quetzalcoatl and his companions were said to have landed when they first reached Mexico, arriving from across the sea in vessels with sides that shone like the scales of serpents' skins. And it was from here, too, that Quetzalcoatl was believed to have sailed on his raft of serpents when he left Central America. Serpent Sanctuary, moreover, was beginning to look like the name for the Olmec homeland, which had included not only Coatzacoalcos, but several other sites in areas less blighted by development. First at Tres Zapotes, west of Coatzacoalcos, and then at San Lorenzo and La Venta, south and east of it, numerous pieces of characteristically Olmec sculpture had been unearthed. All were monoliths, carved out of basalt and similarly durable materials. Some took the form of gigantic heads, weighing up to 30 tons. Others were massive stelae engraved with encounter scenes, apparently involving two different races of mankind, neither of them American Indian. Whoever had produced these outstanding works of art had obviously belonged to a refined, well-organized, prosperous, and technologically advanced civilization. The problem was that absolutely nothing remained except the works of art, from which anything could be deduced about the character and origins of that civilization. All that seemed clear was that the Olmecs, the archaeologists were happy to accept the Aztec designation, had materialized in Central America around 1500 BC with their sophisticated culture fully evolved. Santiago Tuxtla. We passed the night at the fishing port of Alvarado and continued our journey east the next day. The road we were following wound in and out of fertile hills and valleys, giving us occasional views of the Gulf of Mexico before turning inland. We passed green meadows filled with flame trees and little villages nestled in grassy hollows. Here and there we saw private gardens, where hulking pigs grubbed amongst piles of domestic refuse. Then we crested the brow of a hill and looked out across a giant vista of fields and forests bound only by the morning haze and the faint outlines of distant mountains. Some miles further on, we dropped into a hollow. At its bottom lay the old colonial town of Santiago Tuxtla. The place was a riot of color. Garish shop fronts, red tile roofs, yellow straw hats, coconut palms, banana trees, kids in bright clothes. Several of the shops and cafes were playing music from loudspeakers. In the Zocalo, the main square, the air was thick with humidity and the fluttering wings and songs of bright-eyed tropical birds. A leafy little park occupied the center of this square, and in the center of the park, like some magic talisman, stood an enormous gray boulder, almost 10 feet tall, carved in the shape of a helmeted African head. Full-lipped and strong-nosed, its eyes serenely closed, and its lower jaw resting squarely on the ground, this head had a somber and patient gravity. Here, then, was the first mystery of the Olmecs, a monumental piece of sculpture, more than 2,000 years old, which portrayed a subject with unmistakable Negroid features. There were, of course, no African blacks in the New World 2,000 years ago, nor did any arrive until the slave trade began, well after the conquest. There is, however, firm paleoanthropological evidence that one of the many different migrations into the Americas during the last Ice Age did consist of peoples of Negroid stock. This migration occurred around 15,000 BC. Known as the Cobata Head, after the estate on which it was found, the huge monolith in the Zocalo was the largest of 16 similar Olmec sculptures so far excavated in Mexico. It was thought to have been carved not long before the time of Christ, and weighed more than 30 tons. Tres Zapotes. From Santiago Tuxtla, we drove 25 kilometers southwest, through wild and lush countryside to Tres Zapotes, a substantial late Olmec center believed to have flourished between 500 BC and AD 100. Now reduced to a series of mounds, scattered across maize fields, the site had been extensively excavated in 1939-40 by the American archaeologist Matthew Stirling. Historical dogmatists of that period, I remembered, had held tenaciously to the view that the civilization of the Mayas was the oldest in Central America. One could be precise about this, they argued, because the Mayan dot and bar calendrical system, which had recently been decoded, made possible accurate dating of huge numbers of ceremonial inscriptions. The earliest date ever found on a Mayan site corresponded to AD 228 of the Christian calendar. It therefore came as quite a jolt to the academic status quo when Stirling unearthed a stela at Tres Zapotes which bore an earlier date. Written in the familiar bar and dot calendrical code used by the Maya, it corresponded to 3 September 32 BC. What was shocking about this was that Tres Zapotes was not a Maya site, not in any way at all. It was entirely, exclusively, unambiguously Olmec. This suggested that the Olmecs, not the Maya, must have been the inventors of the calendar, and that the Olmecs, not the Maya, ought to be recognized as the mother culture of Central America. Despite determined opposition from gangs of furious Mayanists, the truth which Stirling Spade had unearthed at Tres Zapotes gradually came out. The Olmecs were much, much older than the Maya. They'd been a smart, civilized, technologically advanced people, and they did indeed appear to have invented the bar and dot system of calendrical notation, with the enigmatic starting date of 13 August 3114 BC, which predicted the end of the world in the epoch of AD 2012. Lying close to the calendar stella at Tres Zapotes, Stirling also unearthed a giant head. I sat in front of that head now. Dated to around 100 BC, it was approximately 6 feet high, 18 feet in circumference, and weighed over 10 tons. Like its counterpart in Santiago Tuxtla, it was unmistakably the head of an African man, wearing a close-fitting helmet with long chin straps. The lobes of the ears were pierced by plugs. The pronounced negroid features were furrowed by deep frown lines on either side of the nose, and the entire face was concentrated forwards above thick, down-curving lips. The eyes were open and watchful, almond-shaped and cold. Beneath the curious helmet, the heavy brows appeared beetling and angry. Stirling was amazed by this discovery and reported, "The head was a head only, carved from a single massive block of basalt, and it rested on a prepared foundation of unworked slabs of stone. Cleared of the surrounding earth, it presented an awe-inspiring spectacle. Despite its great size, the workmanship is delicate and sure, the proportions perfect. Unique in its character among Aboriginal American sculptures, it is remarkable for its realistic treatment. The features are bold and amazingly negroid in character." Soon afterwards, the American archaeologist made a second unsettling discovery at Tres Zapotes. Children's toys, in the form of little wheeled dogs. These cute artifacts conflicted head-on with prevailing archaeological opinion, which held that the wheel had remained undiscovered in Central America until the time of the conquest. The dogmobiles proved, at the very least, that the principle of the wheel had been known to the Olmecs, Central America's earliest civilization. And if a people as resourceful as the Olmecs had worked out the principle of the wheel, it seemed highly unlikely that they would have used it just for children's toys. Chapter 17. The Olmec Enigma. After Tres Zapotes, our next stop was San Lorenzo, an Olmec site lying southwest of Coatzacoalcos, in the heart of the serpent sanctuary the legends of Quetzalcoatl made reference to. It was at San Lorenzo that the earliest carbon dates for an Olmec site, around 1500 BC, had been recorded by archaeologists. However, Olmec culture appeared to have been fully evolved by that epoch, and there was no evidence that the evolution had taken place in the vicinity of San Lorenzo. In this, there lay a mystery. The Olmecs, after all, had built a significant civilization which had carried out prodigious engineering works and had developed the capacity to carve and manipulate vast blocks of stone. Several of the huge monolithic heads, weighing 20 tons or more, had been moved as far as 60 miles overland after being quarried in the Tushla Mountains. So where, if not at ancient San Lorenzo, had their technological expertise and sophisticated organization been experimented with, evolved, and refined? Strangely, despite the best efforts of archaeologists, not a single solitary sign of anything that could be described as the developmental phase of Olmec society had been unearthed anywhere in Mexico, or for that matter, anywhere in the New World. These people, whose characteristic form of artistic expression was the carving of huge negroid heads, appeared to have come from nowhere. San Lorenzo. We reached San Lorenzo late in the afternoon. Here, at the dawn of history in Central America, the Olmecs had heaped up an artificial mound more than 100 feet high as part of an immense structure some 4,000 feet in length and 2,000 feet in width. We climbed the dominant mound, now heavily overgrown with thick tropical vegetation, and from the summit we could see for miles across the surrounding countryside. A great many lesser mounds were also visible, and around about were several of the deep trenches the archaeologist Michael Coe had dug when he had excavated the site in 1966. Coe's team made a number of finds here, which included more than 20 artificial reservoirs, linked by a highly sophisticated network of basalt-lined troughs. Part of this system was built into a ridge. When it was rediscovered, water still gushed forth from it during heavy rains, as it had done for more than 3,000 years. The main line of the drainage ran from east to west. Into it, linked by joints made to an advanced design, three subsidiary lines were channeled. After surveying the site thoroughly, the archaeologists admitted that they could not understand the purpose of this elaborate system of sluices and waterworks. Nor were they able to come up with an explanation for another enigma. This was the deliberate burial, along specific alignments, of five of the massive pieces of sculpture showing negroid features, now widely identified as Olmec heads. These peculiar and apparently ritualistic graves also yielded more than 60 precious objects and artifacts, including beautiful instruments made of jade and exquisitely carved statuettes. Some of the statuettes had been systematically mutilated before burial. The way the San Lorenzo sculptures had been interred made it extremely difficult to fix their true age, even though fragments of charcoal were found in the same strata as some of the buried objects. Unlike the sculptures, these charcoal pieces could be carbon dated. They were, and produced readings in the range of 1200 BC. This did not mean, however, that the sculptures had been carved in 1200 BC. They could have been, but they could have originated in a period hundreds or even thousands of years earlier than that. It was by no means impossible that these great works of art, with their intrinsic beauty and an indefinable numinous power, could have been preserved and venerated by many different cultures before being buried at San Lorenzo. The charcoal associated with them proved only that the sculptures were at least as old as 1200 BC. It did not set any upper limit on their antiquity. La Venta. We left San Lorenzo as the sun was going down, heading for the city of Villahermosa, more than 150 kilometers to the east in the province of Tabasco. To get there, we rejoined the main road running from Acayucan to Villahermosa and bypassing the port of Coatzacoalcos in a zone of oil refineries, towering pylons, and ultra-modern suspension bridges. The change of pace between the sleepy rural backwater where San Lorenzo was located and the pockmarked industrial landscape around Coatzacoalcos was almost shocking. Moreover, the only reason that the time-worn outlines of the Olmec site could still be seen at San Lorenzo was that oil had not yet been found there. It had, however, been found at La Venta, to the eternal loss of archaeology. We were now passing La Venta. Due north, off a slip road from the freeway, this sodium-lit petroleum city glowed in the dark like a vision of nuclear disaster. Since the 1940s, it had been extensively developed by the oil industry. An airstrip now bisected the site where a most unusual pyramid had once stood, and flaring smokestacks darkened the sky, which Olmec stargazers must once have searched for the rising of the planets. Lamentably, the bulldozers of the developers had flattened virtually everything of interest before proper excavations could be conducted, with the result that many of the ancient structures had not been explored at all. We will never know what they could have said about the people who built and used them. Matthew Sterling, who excavated Tres Zapotes, carried out the bulk of the archaeological work done at La Venta before progress and oil money erased it. Carbon dating suggested that the Olmecs had established themselves here between 1500 and 1100 BC, and had continued to occupy the site, which consisted of an island lying in the marshes to the east of the Tonala River, until about 400 BC. Then construction was suddenly abandoned. All existing buildings were ceremonially defaced or demolished, and several huge stone heads and other smaller pieces of sculpture were ritually buried in peculiar graves, just as had happened at San Lorenzo. The La Venta graves were elaborate and carefully prepared, lined with thousands of tiny blue tiles and filled up with layers of multicolored clay. At one spot, some 15,000 cubic feet of earth had been dug out of the ground to make a deep pit. Its floor had been carefully covered with serpentine blocks and all the earth put back. Three mosaic pavements were also found, intentionally buried beneath several alternating layers of clay and adobe. La Venta's principal pyramid stood at the southern end of the site. Roughly circular at ground level, it took the form of a fluted cone, the rounded sides consisting of 10 vertical ridges with gullies between. The pyramid was 100 feet tall, almost 200 feet in diameter, and had an overall mass in the region of 300,000 cubic feet, an impressive monument by any standards. The remainder of the site stretched for almost half a kilometer along an axis that pointed precisely 8 degrees west of north. Centered on this axis, with every structure in flawless alignment, were several smaller pyramids and plazas, platforms and mounds, covering a total area of more than 3 square miles. There was something detached and odd about La Venta, a sense that its original function had not been properly understood. Archaeologists referred to it as a ceremonial center, and very probably that is what it was. If one were honest, however, one would have to admit that it could also have been several other things. The truth is that nothing is known about the social organization, ceremonies, and belief systems of the Olmecs. We do not know what language they spoke, or what traditions they passed to their children. We don't even know what ethnic group they belonged to. The exceptionally humid conditions of the Gulf of Mexico mean that not a single Olmec skeleton has survived. In reality, despite the names we have given them and the views we've formed about them, these people are completely obscure to us. It is even possible that the enigmatic sculptures they left behind, which we presume depicted them, were not their work at all, but the work of a far earlier and forgotten people. Not for the first time, I found myself wondering whether some of the great heads and other remarkable artifacts attributed to the Olmecs might not have been handed down like heirlooms, perhaps over many millennia, to the cultures which eventually began to build the mounds and pyramids at San Lorenzo and La Venta. If so, then who are we speaking of when we use the label Olmec? The mound builders? Or the powerful and imposing men with negroid features who provided the models for the monolithic heads? Fortunately, some 50 pieces of Olmec monumental sculpture, including 3 of the giant heads, were rescued from La Venta by Carlos Pellicer Camara, a local poet and historian who intervened forcefully when he discovered that oil drilling by the Pemex company jeopardized the ruins. By determined lobbying of the politicians of Tabasco, within which La Venta lies, he arranged to have the significant finds moved to a park on the outskirts of the regional capital, Villahermosa. Taken together, these finds constitute a precious and irreplaceable cultural record, or rather, a whole library of cultural records left behind by a vanished civilization. But nobody knows how to read the language of those records. Deus ex machina. Via Hermosa, Tabasco Province. I was looking at an elaborate relief that had been dubbed Man in Serpent by the archaeologists who found it at La Venta. According to expert opinion, it showed an Olmec wearing a headdress and holding an incense bag enveloped by a feathered serpent. The relief was carved into a slab of solid granite, measuring about 4 feet wide by 5 feet high, and showed a man sitting with his legs stretched out in front of him as though he were reaching for pedals with his feet. He held a small, bucket-shaped object in his right hand. With his left, he appeared to be raising or lowering a lever. The headdress he wore was an odd and complicated garment. To my eye, it seemed more functional than ceremonial, although I could not imagine what its function might have been. On it, or perhaps on a console above it, were two X-shaped crosses. I turned my attention to the other principal element of the sculpture, the feathered serpent. On one level it did indeed depict exactly that, a plumed or feathered serpent, the age-old symbol of Quetzalcoatl, whom the Olmecs, therefore, must have worshipped, or at the very least recognized. Scholars do not dispute this interpretation. It is generally accepted that Quetzalcoatl's cult was immensely ancient, originating in prehistoric times in Central America, and thereafter receiving the devotion of many cultures during the historic period. The feathered serpent in this particular sculpture, however, had certain characteristics that set it apart. It seemed to be more than just a religious symbol. Indeed, there was something rigid and structured about it that made it look almost like a piece of machinery. Whispers of Ancient Secrets. Later that day, I took shelter in the giant shadow cast by one of the Olmec heads Carlot Palisa Camara had rescued from La Venta. It was the head of an old man, with a broad, flat nose and thick lips. The lips were slightly parted, exposing strong, square teeth. The expression of the face suggested an ancient, patient wisdom, and the eyes seemed to gaze unafraid into eternity like those of the great Sphinx at Giza in Lower Egypt. It would probably be impossible, I thought, for a sculptor to invent all the different combined characteristics of an authentic racial type. The portrayal of an authentic combination of racial characteristics therefore implied strongly that a human model had been used. I walked around the great head a couple of times. It was 22 feet in circumference, weighed 19.8 tons, stood almost 8 feet high, had been carved out of solid basalt, and displayed clearly an authentic combination of racial characteristics. Indeed, like the other pieces I had seen at Santiago Tuxtla and at Tres Zapotes, it unmistakably and unambiguously showed a Negro. My own view is that the Olmec heads present us with physiologically accurate images of real individuals of Negroid stock, charismatic and powerful African men whose presence in Central America 3,000 years ago has not yet been explained by scholars. Nor is there any certainty that the heads were actually carved in that epoch. Carbon dating of fragments of charcoal found in the same pits tells us only the age of the charcoal. Calculating the true antiquity of the heads themselves is a much more complex matter. It was with such thoughts that I continued my slow walk among the strange and wonderful monuments of La Venta. They whispered of ancient secrets. The secret of the man in the machine. The secret of the Negro heads. And last but not least, the secret of a legend brought to life. For it seemed that flesh might indeed have been put on the mythical bones of Quetzalcoatl. When I found that several of the La Venta sculptures contained realistic likenesses, not only of Negroes, but of tall, thin-featured, long-nosed, apparently Caucasian men with straight hair and full beards, wearing flowing robes. Chapter 18. Conspicuous Strangers. Matthew Sterling, the American archaeologist who excavated La Venta in the 1940s, made a number of spectacular discoveries there. The most spectacular of all was the stele of the bearded man. The plan of the ancient Olmec site, as I've said, lay along an axis pointing 8 degrees west of north. At the southern end of this axis, 100 feet tall, loomed the fluted cone of the Great Pyramid. Next to it, at ground level, was what looked like a curb, about 1 foot high, enclosing a spacious rectangular area 1/4 the size of an average city block. When the archaeologists began to uncover this curb, they found, to their surprise, that it consisted of the upper parts of a wall of columns. Further excavation through the undisturbed layers of stratification that had accumulated revealed that the columns were 10 feet tall. There were more than 600 of them, and they had been set together so closely that they formed a near impregnable stockade. Hewn out of solid basalt and transported to La Venta from quarries more than 60 miles distant, the columns weighed approximately 2 tons each. Why all this trouble? What had the stockade been built to contain? Even before excavation began, the tip of a massive chunk of rock had been visible, jutting out of the ground in the center of the enclosed area, about 4 feet higher than the illusory curb, and leaning steeply forward. It was covered with carvings. These extended down out of sight beneath the layers of soil that filled the ancient stockade to a height of about 9 feet. Stirling and his team worked for 2 days to free the great rock. When exposed, it proved to be an imposing stele, 14 feet high, 7 feet wide, and almost 3 feet thick. The carvings showed an encounter between 2 tall men, both dressed in elaborate robes and wearing elegant shoes with turned-up toes. Either erosion or deliberate mutilation, quite commonly practiced on Olmec monuments, had resulted in the complete defacement of one of the figures. The other was intact. It so obviously depicted a Caucasian male with a high-bridged nose and a long flowing beard that the bemused archaeologists promptly christened it Uncle Sam. I walked slowly around the 20-ton stele, remembering as I did so